move straight into the presentation. And I think, Co-Chair, do we call this a half an hour presentation? 30 minutes? Thank you.
Let's
over to the Co-Chair, who may wish to say a few words.
No, thank you very much. I'd like to indicate as well that the Joint Budget Committee consists of the members of the NPA and the whole, like you said, committee on finance. Unfortunately, this meeting is clashing with a workshop for the Select Committee on Finance. That's why the members are not being paid from time to time and come in and out, but they are having another workshop. And, so if you don't see them here, it's not because they are advertising on the site, but they are doing some other work. So thank you very much.
Thank you, honourable co-chairs and honourable members, and thank you for this opportunity to present to you our thoughts around the medium-term budget policy statement. Let me introduce firstly behind me, Mr. Parag Patel. He's my Deputy Director General for Planning and Monitoring, so he deals largely with the sector budget issues of the provincial budget. And on my right, Mr. Bernardi, our Chief Financial Officer, who deals with departmental budget. Chair, I will certainly try to respond to all the items in your letter of invitation. I hope it won't be seen as a cosmetic presentation. I think we were asked to indicate some of our achievements, and certainly we want to do that, but I do think we have done at last, and certainly towards the end of the presentation, have raised some very significant challenges, I think, for ourselves in the education sector. We're not going to do an electronic presentation. I trust everybody has a hard copy, and if it's all right, we'd want to look through that. It's not easy. Chair, so as I say, this is dealing with Vote 13, the education, National Education Department budget, and as I say, these are our views. The first page, Madam Chair, really is just a listing of all the items in your letter of invitation, so just to indicate the content of the presentation. We'll move through, as I say, some of the achievements and progress we have made. Turning to some of the figures, where I'll hand over to my CFO to talk specifically around some of the budgetary matters, and then perhaps I'll return when we talk about some of the challenges and unfunded mandates that I'm sure you want to hear about. Chair, in terms of the policy priorities of the department, as listed in our strategic plan over this five-year period, the two main ones that stand out very strongly, dealing with poverty and skills development. That ultimately is the big areas that we deal with. In terms of dealing with poverty, a number of different areas. We obviously trying to pursue the no-fee school policy. The Kids Up program, which the Minister described as the affirmative action program for poor schools, continues. The school nutrition program, I'll come back to. An increasing focus on rural education, where most of the poor are in fact living. And, of course, in higher education level, our National Student Financial Aid Scheme, first student loan, substantial scheme, certainly that's in the future. On skills development, apart from obviously the normal school curriculum, we're very proud of the new National Certificate Vocational, that's the NCV program that's been offered in IPC colleges, and we have a first cohort coming out this year. The literacy campaign, Kale Gudi, we'll talk to later, as well as the ongoing ABET work. And then, of course, you would be aware that the Minister of Education has now been mandated to lead the National Human Resource Development Strategy, and that process is unfolding as we speak. In support, perhaps, of those two big areas of poverty and skills development, a number of other what we might term enabling factors. One is the issue of health and education, I think, an area of concern for all of us. We do have a nice skills program in our schools that deals strictly with HIV prevention strategies. Increasing number of schools offering physical education, and I'm glad to say very good cooperation now with the Department of Sport and Recreation around school sports provision. And of course, this Parliament last year passed legislation around putting random searches for drugs and weapons, and many schools are reacting very positively on this and indicating they're able to manage these aspects much better with that. We're continuing with the program of institutional development. Higher education level, implementing the national plan around mergers and transformation of our higher education institutions. The FET College recapitalization runs to an end this year. Little footnote here, we're certainly hoping that that funding isn't now going to suddenly drop, given that the conditional grant has ended. Very important for all of us, the clarification of the roles and responsibilities of our education system. What are districts, what are they supposed to do, and what do they need in order to do that? We've got a draft policy now around that that I think will change the landscape. And ultimately, we're also talking about quality improvements. We do now, for the first time this year, have a national curriculum statement that runs all the way from grade R to grade 12, I think a modern and relevant curriculum. We conduct systemic evaluations on a regular basis to check how the system is performing in that regard, and there's a lot of good news there that the Minister will be revealing next week. The Minister has also initiated the Foundation for Learning program to try and ensure that children get the best possible start in their school career. We have an integrated quality management system, largely around issues of teacher performance, that is moving us towards the so-called inspectorate, so we'll have to find the name for it, but that is there. And a continuing improvement on our infrastructure and LTSM. We have seen some deliveries in the course of the year that are sort of got that. So those are priorities. That's what we said we wanted to do. And the next one then looks at progress in regard to those, in regard to measurable objectives and indicators. And starting at the bottom of the system with our grade R, you know that by 2010 we are committed to universal enrollment of grade R. I'm happy to say we've got over 600,000 learners there in our public grade R classes. Clearly there are a lot more in private grade R institutions, but we're confident that we're moving towards that target of approximately 1 million as the cohort in grade R by 2010, currently, as I say, over 600,000. Also, I think a significant development, funding norms for the funding of grade R classes have been approved and gazetted. Those now become binding on Cognizant. In regard to schools, we have, of course, achieved universal primary enrollment, so we believe that certainly all children of school-going age, 7 to 15, are indeed enrolled, and more importantly, perhaps, we've achieved gender parity at those levels. In fact, if anything, of course, we've got a concern with the absence of participation of boys, particularly at a higher level, so certainly in terms of girls, they are participating. This year, interestingly, we have now 1 million learners in grade 11, so despite the stories about massive dropouts, in fact, we're not finding that certainly up until grade 11, the full cohort is progressing, and we would believe that next year we will see for the first time probably a full number of 1 million learners getting through to matric in 2009, clearly an important element. And critical units we've set up is what we call the Learner Unit Records and Tracking System, which is LURIS. We have just established that within the last month. This will be an individual record of every single learner in the system. We'll be able to track their progress, find out if they dropped out of school, if they moved school, whatever it is. We've only started a month ago. We've uploaded the information from 800 schools so far into the database. We're certainly targeting 4,000 by the end of this financial year, and certainly during the coming financial year, we would want to see all of our schools uploaded into the LURIS system. That's some 12 million records we would have of the children in our system. This year, big year, crunch year, and a very testing one, the new national senior certificate, the new matric effectively, is going to be written this year. This is a matric that has maths or maths literacy as a compulsory element, a lot of effort's been put into trying to prepare our learners for this, but obviously a lot of anxiety around this, and that's probably justified. So what perhaps hasn't captured the news is that during the course of this year, because we changed the curriculum, we had to give those who had written under the old curriculum a second chance, and we had some 400,000 learners who wrote the second chance papers earlier this year, including many who otherwise had dropped out of the school system. So a really valuable, I think, opportunity, and we'll be carrying it on over the next couple of years to try and mop up all of those who never got through the tricks under the old system. And just a few comments, in the lady schools, we've got 500 of them operational, some 300 of them now being internet connected, and we can see that that's the core of our new maths and science cadres in the country. In some of the other areas as well, in ABET, we've got over 200,000 learners registered in our public adult learning centres. And again, today we have an approval from National Treasury for the funding norms for ABS, and these have been introduced now as policy and will be implemented. The Kali Goodie Math Literacy Campaign has been an overwhelming success, I think. We targeted 300,000 learners during the course of this year as a step-up year, as it were. We have, in fact, enrolled 360,000 learners, and we'll come back to it, but Treasury has been very generous in allowing us the extra cost for those. I think even they were convinced by the argument that said if an illiterate learner arrives at your door, you can't turn them away and say, wait till next year, you have to enroll them. We have done so, and we've got the money for that, and they have produced learning materials, all of them, official languages, and a brave one as well. So wonderful work being done there. Inclusive education, still rather slow to move and rather dependent, I'm afraid, on donor funds still. We have been able to train 1,600 teachers and district officials, and unfortunately, special schools and ordinary schools being converted into full service schools are currently being refurbished as part of that inclusive education program. Finally, on higher education, we annually have some 780,000 students registered in our public higher education institutions. Others, of course, in private higher education providers. In terms of graduation in 2007, 130,000 of them graduated. We're continuing, I think, to get a better understanding of the higher education system, and one thing we're using is performance measures, which are comparing the data on enrollment and graduation against the plans that the institution produced. They have three-year rolling plans, and we're checking that they are enrolling against those plans, and more importantly, that they graduate against those plans, and at the same time monitoring issues of output efficiency. Are we getting the products that we need? Is the infrastructure being developed, particularly the new money that we put into these institutions? And also, are they providing foundation programs? I think the evidence that foundation programs really do assist learners to graduate is there to be seen. And just two other elements that I think we would comment on. The Mfundo Lushaka bursary, these are for student teachers. The value of these is about 50,000 rand per bursary now. So it's a full cost bursary, fees, residence accommodation, books. It even involves a bit of pocket money, so there should be no student who said they could not afford to go to university to become a teacher. And we've got nearly 5,000 of them in the pipeline at the moment, and obviously we can grow year on year. And the school nutrition program. Over 6 million children being fed every school day, notwithstanding some of the difficulties we face. I think we need to recognize that the progress there. Madam Chair, the request was also that we just refer to the Millennium Development Goals and the three that pertain to education. One is the issue of universal primary education, and while we do report the international survey, the 98% participation rate in primary education, we need to recognize that that is based on census data, so the difference of 2% might be in some ways a statistical error. We're not convinced that there are that many children, in fact, outside of school, and certainly we do have places for them, but we would say that the LURID data, particularly when it's connected, for example, to our Home Affairs database, will enable us to ensure that every child who is born, we would want to see after 6 years, that they suddenly come onto the LURID database, so we would be able to ensure that 100% is sure. On gender parity, as I said earlier, certainly it has been achieved at all levels of the system. The concern in grade 11 and 12, in fact, is about boys, either in terms of participation, but sometimes also in terms of performance. It's safe to say it, but girls generally tend to be better in our matric than in our boys. And on adult literacy, of course, this is one that's been lagging behind. We estimate something like 9.4 million South Africans who are illiterate. Kali Goodie, in line with the Millennium Development Goals of halving illiteracy by 2015, we targeted the 4.7 million illiterate adults by 2012. So from the 360,000 we've got enrolled this year, we will step up in the next 3 years to 1.2 million learners a year, and then the final year of mopping up the remaining 4.7 million. So certainly making progress on that one, and I trust we can continue to do it. Chair, I'm going to pause then now and hand over to my CFO just to talk about some of the things.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. speaking to the figures, we'll briefly look at what is happening this financial year and then a glimpse on the way forward. The medium-term budget policy statement of the Minister of Finance last Tuesday spoke to some additional funds for this year as well as for the new medium-term. And of course, we know that the adjustment estimate has been passed to Parliament on Thursday. So this first slide, what gives an indication is just to say that in the education system as such, that national department as well as the nine provincial education departments, the budget for this year was 123 billion rand. Up to the end of September, 67 billion or 54.9%, which is more than 50%, has actually been spent. It can indicate that most provinces are projecting some over-expenditure. Now that also very often happens in the course of the financial year. Of course, there's close interaction with the provinces to assist them to downspend where it is necessary. But they are also expecting some additional funds in the adjustment estimate coming to them, and which has not yet been finalized in the provinces. One of the aspects that could be highlighted that is a bit of a dispute at this point in time is money around the OSD, the improvement of the conditions of service of educators, where the money has been set aside by some provincial education departments. Have given us an indication that the money is not being allocated to them yet from their provincial treasury, and as from tomorrow, we are busy with a round of provincial visits to all nine provinces to try and sort out this problem. The next slide, Honourable Chair, is just an indication of, in the National Department, what has happened in the adjustment estimate for this year. Funds have been rolled over to the value of 32.7 billion, million. Conditional grant, a further 3.3 million, and that conditional grant is now mainly in terms of the HIV and AIDS conditional grant in KwaZulu-Natal, where the money was not spent in the previous financial year. There are further adjustments of 461 million that's been added to the vote of the department. For the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, 39 million, and these are inflation-related adjustments. For the school nutrition program, 79 million, and for higher education institutions, subsidies, 343 million. Then, further in addition to that, for unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure, again the school nutrition scheme, 265 million additional, and that then takes the total for the year up to about 1.6 billion rand. And for the Caribbean math literacy campaign, the Director General has indicated that we actually over-enrolled by 20%, a further 107 million to cater for those expenses. And then disaster management around some storm damage and so forth in KwaZulu-Natal and the Mpumalanga school, 22 million that will flow as a conditional grant by our department. Then in the provinces, it is expected that another 5 billion will go towards salaries and other inflation-related costs, a further 2.2 billion. And that will partially address the figures I indicated on the previous slide of possible over-expenditure in the provinces. If we then turn to the new 3-year MTAF budget cycle and what has been slashed by the Minister of Finance in the in medium-term budget policy statement, which we know, because all the detail is not yet available, so we can only speak to what we know. I must indicate that there is very strong interaction between National Treasury and ourselves at this stage of time to smash it out and ensure that when we get the final allocation method by about the end of November, it will all become much more clear. But on the school nutrition program, the indication has been given by the Minister of Finance that there will be an extra or an additional 4 billion coming from 2009-10 for the next 3 years. Now, the department requested about 7 billion additional, and the purpose of that is deliberately there to also implement the school nutrition program in secondary schools and possibly also in the quintile 1, 2, and 3 schools. Of poor because at present there is no provision for feeding in secondary school. Then the unit to evaluate school and teacher performance. A bid has also been put in for that priority area, 165 million, 181 million, 199 million for the 3-year cycle. Now, it has been mentioned by the Minister of Finance in his statement, but we do not yet have an indication of the possible amounts that will be awarded. For school infrastructure, specifically for libraries, sports fields, laboratories, grade art classes, and so forth, you can see the bid amount. This is quite a huge bid of about 30, 14 billion rand. There's an indication that for these purposes, something like 4.1 billion will be allocated additionally over the NPS period, but we are not yet sure of the part of that that will be specifically for education and how it will be allocated over the 3-year period. Then the recapitalization of technical high school. The DG mentioned that this is the last year of the recapitalization of the FEC colleges. So we want to embark on the same process with technical high school, and we therefore put in a bid of 500 million over the NPS period for that purpose. It was also mentioned by the Minister of Finance, but no indication of specific amounts yet allocated for that purpose. Then there are some departmental bids that were also put in from the department side, but which we have no indication at this point in time whether funds will be allocated or not. And I'm again speaking there of the Department of Education and not of the sector bids as such for provincial money. Higher education institutions, human resource development strategy for South Africa, that is indicated that this is now a responsibility of our department. A lot of centers of schools, the Caligulia math literacy campaign, due to the excess rate of income, we need to excel the program and therefore request a substantial additional funding for the system. A small amount for ministerial innovation and support fund. And then for our public entities, a smaller bid for NS5, SACWA, Maluki, SAFE, and CAG. Then, honorable chairpersons, if we look at sector funding, bids that we don't have an indication of amounts for additional funding yet at this stage, extending the NOC school, lowering the learner educator ratio, inclusive and special education, grade R, textbooks, and district development. Some of these priority areas have been mentioned in the Minister of Finance's medium-term budget policy statement, but no indication of any amounts at this stage. And as I indicated earlier, it's still an ongoing discussion between National Treasury and ourselves.
Thank you. And if I can conclude, and it's only one slide, but specific slide, and that's the one that talks largely to the concerns you face. What are the other issues that we have to face? The first one, I think, that's fairly all in the face on a daily basis, is the issue of the infrastructure backlog. You know we now have an electronic infrastructure management system, we have an electronic record, including photographs of every single school in the country, full pipe plan and layout of water sanitation, etc. And based on that, we've done an assessment of potentially what is the funding gap. So that, when we present to Cabinet, will certainly be in excess of some 50 billion rand. So there's a significant challenge we face around that one. Cabinet has directed us to look at innovative funding mechanisms to try and address this matter. We're engaged in a number of processes now, including with some international agencies, to try and find ways in which we can deal with this infrastructure backlog in the soonest possible time, even if it means we have to indeed go out and borrow money and pay it back or whatever else. But we would know that the issue of buildings is still a major concern, the provision of schools and classrooms themselves, but also, of course, where there are schools and classrooms, the provision of clean water, a major challenge, sanitation, I think, an absolute embarrassment that many schools still do not have adequate sanitation. Electricity, well, we certainly want to see that rolled out as well, particularly as we now move into an IT age. So that probably is the biggest one that we're facing at the moment, and unless we can find something there, we're certainly going to face an ongoing challenge around the quality of education. We are not yet convinced, secondly, that the per capita allocation that we make, this is the allocation made over and above your personnel, over and above your capital spending. This is essentially the free money that schools have to purchase things like paper, learning materials, equipment, etc. So we have at the moment a figure around 700 rand, I think, per learner at the lowest level. We're not yet sure that that is sufficient to buy what could be termed a quality education, and certainly we want to continue to motivate for increases, particularly in the low-fee schools. Other schools have the ability to top up those allocations with private income, but low-fee schools are not permitted to do that, and we really would want to see a situation where they were indeed adequately funded. The school nutrition program, I think, is one of our successes, and already people are reporting enormous differences in school attendance in relation to school nutrition. When children are being fed, children tend to go to school. So we want to see this thing extended, certainly to secondary school, but we need to take account also of rising food costs. We want to be sure that this is indeed a nutrition program and not, as someone said, just a feeding program. You give people bread and a bit of peanut butter, sure, that's a feeding program, whether it's a nutrition program or something different, and we're continuing to look at things like mineral and different supplements, etc., that we can ensure that children are taking the necessary nutrients they need. And then finally, the transport issues are an ongoing challenge. More and more provinces are, in fact, dealing with these issues, but they themselves, of course, are faced with the increased cost of travel, petrol price increases, etc., so that certainly we want to be an area that we want to highlight as well. So really, those, Chair, I think, are the areas that we haven't yet dealt with, and those are areas I suppose we want to continue investing with the National Treasury. With that, Chair, I think we've covered, so thank you very much, and obviously, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. There's just one thing you may wish to add before the committee comes in with some questions, and that is, you noted here, of course, that one of the areas, that the broader area of dealing with poverty and the linkage with the two. And when you spoke on the NSFAS bursaries and loans, really you were quite economic in your information. And I wonder if you could just give us a little bit more before we engage.
Sorry, I just hear the figures there. You're right, Major, and it's probably one we've underpaid overall. The figure at the moment is approximately 1.7 billion a year that is providing bursary to in excess of 200,000, I think, students. So there's some 200,000 students benefiting from NS Plus. One important element is that in this financial year, over 300 million has been topped up now from previous students who have graduated. And of course, we have a very good arrangement with the receiver of revenue. The minute you start working, you start paying back the NSFAS loan, and we are therefore now starting to regenerate the funds into the NSFAS system. And this year, over 300 to 400 million has been paid back. I'm not sure if that's the information you're looking for, but that was certainly what we provided.
Well, let's allow the committee to engage on some of these points. Thank you. Members, let's take the questions, comments, etc. Perhaps we can take 4 or 5 at a time. Yes, the Honourable Chairman. Thank you. It's just the members at the moment.
Thanks very much, Chairperson, and thanks to the department for the presentation. But one or two questions I'd just like to ask. And obviously, we're dealing with expenditure patterns over the NPA. And the one area where there's going to be an increase in expenditure on the school nutrition program, and I just want to find out how, over this MTA, we're going to be able to ensure that all children get access to the food system provided. And I ask this specifically because And I heard on the radio that in Gauteng last year, there was a whole group of children that didn't get access to food. And I was quite stunned by that, because I was under the impression that this was one of the crucial programs of government. But in yet, it seems to me, there seems to be a lack of planning somewhere along the line. And I'm a little bit concerned, because if we're seeing such a big amount now being allocated, increases, and we can't even plan for what we currently get, which I must say I find quite unacceptable. I'd like to find out, if you could elaborate a little bit more, how are we going to use this money? How are we going to actually ensure that every single child who's supposed to get that meal actually gets that meal? It cannot be correct that we come a year later in an annual report and then get told that there was some budgetary problem. It's absolutely unacceptable. And even more what unacceptable is we are the ones that must go and face people and explain. And I really think it's wrong. And so I'd like to get more on that. The other thing, the MCS statement talks about increases in funding for school infrastructure. Now, last week, we had a briefing by the Human Sciences Research Council. And here again, I must say, it's quite shocking, quite startling, really, when you use that word. But they told us that there are plus minus 2,000 schools still in South Africa that do not have access to water and sanitation. Now, that comes from the Human Sciences Research Council to a briefing to us last week. How are we going to actually deal with this? I must admit, I'm starting to really, I'm failing to understand. We're going into the fourth decade. So in 5 years' time, it'll be 20 years since 1994. Surely we can't still be saying that, you know, it's this and it's that. I'd like to know, over the next 3 years, how are we going to deal with this problem? To make sure that these schools get water and sanitation. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Honourable Chair, the then president in 2002 said there should be no children that went under. And in the sense, the president was saying that there should be minimum standards in terms of infrastructure and human resources. I just would like to ask the question whether there are minimum standards, and then if so, what are they? And secondly, if they are there, how many schools qualify? And if there are plans to correct and the corruption situation, and how much the budget is for that in this three-year plan. Thank you.
Honourable Chief, thank you, President. My question will be on the Northeast School, because you know that there are no standards. For an example, within the same vicinity, one school is a quintal 1, another one is a quintal 3. And from the farming area where my constituency is, that school is around the farm and it's not for white servants, it's for the farm worker servants, and it's classified as a quintal 3 school. So I'd like to know all this money that is being allocated, what has been placed to remedy this mismatch of finding other programs and not other plans, because we realize that there's a challenging implementation for assessing these schools. How do they keep these schools to qualify them for no school? And another one is still around the farming area where we foresee a poverty trap. All those children around the farming area going up to Senate grade, because of the terrorist fight for grade. And there's no high school around, and they can't go anywhere. And you can see a very big school here around the farm, but it's not fully supported by the province, by the federal province or national government, I don't know. These students don't go to school, but there's a school around here. There's nothing to take these students to that school. And how are we going to break that poverty trend if such issues are not attended to, like transport or making sure that those children, as they are little, some schools are being serviced to a high school around that farm. So that's one of my concerns. Thank you.
Thank you.
Asking me from the point of oversight constituency, have said to the person, I think the person, it will not be, I would not advise the department to stop it now, because I think that there is still a need out there. I mean, we're talking about the situation of about the schools, which were once designed not to carry the same what you call the standard of education. Now, if we are to update those to the same standard, you can't talk 3 years and think that now. Now, everybody now is on the same path. It's not. The Renaulty School, again, I think that at the beginning of the year we raised this question, whether the schools have already received this money. And I was surprised last week to find that some of the schools have not yet received their allocation for the Renaulty School. And those schools are expected to operate very soon, end of the year. We are asking those schools, why are you not active? So that, but also from our side, as a department, if the schools have not completed, how are they to operate in half the month? So all I'm saying is that there are six questions around the allocation of the work, so that the issue of the local school. I mean, it's a very important what you call an intervention, but the schools must receive I think that maybe that my last comment will be on the on NESCA. Unfortunately, I do not see the annual report of NESCA. I'm not sure that it's part of it. But I always wonder as to really, again, see the impact of the North East School. You know, if you're going out there in the constituency, the ordinary people whose children are not able to attend the meeting, they will tell you that, well, if you're not belonging to a particular class, your kids will not have access to this one because they have a fund, NEPFAS. But this fund is meant to assist poor students to access education. But the parents are saying their children can't access it because they are poor. Now, there is such imbalance now. I don't know in terms of monitoring, whether do we do sometimes what checks in terms of this child will get access to this, is it the right one? Because it is not my child. It is not a college those or the fast, but because the children. Yeah, the children who are really in need are not accessing this particular. What is it that we do to ensure that it is the right, what we call it, I mean, the target is the right student. That's the last one, the real last one. It's inhalation. You know, there's a very good program called the Inhalation School, specializing in mathematics. But it's in 2008, where unemployment is so high, where there's such a demand for math and science out there. And we know that in those schools which don't fall in the category of the Nadine, it means that their standards are not what they call up to the same standard as those who have access to the Nadine. When are we thinking of rolling out this program to each and every school? Because I mean, this is not a question of a choice. Department has taken policy that each and every school must offer a net. But now the question is, what standards of net is offered by the different schools? And when are we going to have a solution to offer?
Thank you,
Honorable
Secretary. Can you hear me? Yeah, you
No, thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I'm dealing with a challenge. Yes, saying maybe we. I mean, I know we're talking about the budgetary priority today, but I'm also saying the budget follows the policy and the strategy of the department to do certain things. And some of the questions we ask really are supposed to be questions we ask strongly from the department more than, you know, just budgetary questions. For me, the reality really, which is linked to the very first question, the reality is very little have changed from 1994. When you look at the pattern of our schools and education, those schools that were meant to groom people for certain aspects that we don't want to go to now are still performing that role, and other schools. So we, there's this tendency of tweaking here and there, but the fundamental, you know, what business of school is really not happening. Now I'm looking at some of the suggestions here and looking at what we've always regarded as priorities, and what is said as priority even here is really, you know, fall into the list of not agreed to, you know, not funded for, and all that. Now I'm just wondering, at what stage, seriousness about school is really going to take place? Now, see, I'm also saying this. Aware of the fact that within this review of what is it that we've achieved in the last 15 years and what is it that we want to do moving ahead, education has been identified, education and health, but in particular education has been identified as one area that can save this country. One area that can, you know, empower, not only empower, but also leverage the future, you know, of this country. Now we're sitting with a problem up to now where not only you expect government to give huge amounts for subsidy houses. We're sitting with a problem where we talk about grants, these social grants. Now, I'm saying when we do this budget and the education policy, at some stage we need to say until when is the government going to give social grants and even government subsidies. Are we, like other countries, won't we have a cut that is saying it needs to show that this country has been free from 94, and therefore all those kids who are, whatever you want to call them, born free or whatever, all those kids who were part of the new policy, we know definitely when they reach their adulthood, there won't be a need for, you know, a government subsidy house, there won't be a need for a social grant, there won't be a need for this. And for me, you can only do that if you're going to break the poverty trap, whether a child comes from a very, very poor rural area, that child will get a quality education that by the time he passes matric, the future is bright. But, you know, I'm saying that, also saying, you know, when I look around, I'm not even talking about deep rural areas in Lady Frere or whatever. I'm talking about Kubuletu. If you go today to a township of Kubuletu, to Manenberg, to Bonthever, no, those areas are very, very near. They are part of urban areas. If you go to those schools compared to finance and other schools, there's a vast difference. And as a parent, you know, if you take your child to Bonthever and take your child to finance, definitely the result and the outcome, let alone the drugs and this you get in that particular school, but the education outcome is not the same. And why is that 15 years down the line? I started by saying maybe these are not questions that are supposed to be directed at a financial, you know, presentation. They are supposed to be directed at a policy. But I'm saying them because this finance is supposed to follow that policy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable. This is something from our health department here. I look at this and perhaps the question I ask myself, we would probably say we are all agreed that we are striving. Our vision is that we are a developmental state. So then the question is this a developmental framework? But it's no. And I say that notwithstanding, I can see the hard work that's gone into this. What I often have to say to colleagues, comrades, and friends, it's not a question simply of hard work. That is it. It is essential, but it's not sufficient. And you read out the policy priorities, which made it clear that you have a good idea what the policy priorities are. And that's been the problem with us, if we are honest as government, that we do know our policy priorities. Isn't anybody who doesn't. The issue is in the translation of the policy priorities into the financial allocation and human resource. Resources are not just money. The problem is that what we often think. And I just say to the secretary here, Co-Chair, we may be making a big mistake with the JVC here. And not having advice of the minister, who is responsible for policy priorities. Now, if Jacob was sitting here, he's going to look at me and say, yes, I know, but, you know, and that's about all he's going to say. So I ask myself why I'm even asking this question. But I'm asking this question because it is an indictment for any MP here. To sit here with a current quality of learner coming out. It's an indictment on everyone in this room. And you wait till you get out in the field. If you don't know what I'm saying and feeling it here, you're going to feel it out there. And it's pointless on the denial route. So we have a job to do. And that job is to tell South Africa, yes, you know what? Manuel saying, well, and what is this new power to tweak the budget? you know what? We're not going to be tweaking any budget. We're going to be transforming the budget. Let's get that straight. Anyone who thinks we're tweaking anything must have gone to a manicure. We're not tweaking anything. We get our job here is to ensure that an ANC-led government, which is a sector government, is leading us. That the policies here are going to translate to make the impact that people
they line. We are going to produce learners. What one honourable colleague has pointed out, where the learner will no longer require financial support and subsidy. That is the goal. Our goal is not a welfare state. Our goal is a developmental state. And there is a very big difference in that. Now, the couple of things I want to know is when we went into the budget, when we came in, 1994, we were all told this incremental budgeting issue is out. You know, the last government did this. And are we not going to do that? We're not going to do that. We're going to do zero-based budgeting. We're going to look at the current situation, the backlog, and that is how we're going to develop the budget. But I'm asking myself, and I'm asking the co-chair with whom I've served now 14 years, can you see any difference to 94? What's this, an incremental budget? I'm asking you, gentlemen, really, I know you're busy. Can you honestly sit there and tell me that you are addressing these priorities? Are you honestly addressing them? And I want you to be able to tell the committee that. Because there's no disloyalty and there's nothing wrong in retaining political integrity and the integrity of the budget. Now over to the department to respond not cosmetically but realistically.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks to all the others who have commented, and we will try collectively to respond as we can. Let me respond to your last question, which I think is probably the nub of the matter, and I think the answer has to be yes, we are addressing the priorities. I think the question is whether we are doing so sufficiently and whether we are doing so at a sufficient pace is obviously the question, and probably many would say that we're not doing so. Indeed, it might be, as you suggested, more of a political debate rather than ourselves as officials. We get a direction, we are asked to implement that, to do that, and let me just remind the House, of course, that on an annual basis we do bring the strategic plan of the department, both the five-year plan and the one-year plan, to Parliament. We present it to our portfolio committee. They then sign off on that effectively. If we've been wrong, then I think, as you say, collectively we'll be wrong, and we need to find ways to deal with that. Without going into the debate, Chair, I think it could be a discussion point about what has changed since 1994. I think from our side, certainly, we are seeing changes indeed, and have seen changes certainly, and perhaps all I would refer to here was the recent review of education that was conducted by the OECD for this government, probably best to refer members to that particular report, which I think does recognise significant changes and developments that have taken place since 1994, but whether those are sufficient or not, I think is another issue, and therefore probably would be good at another stage to go into and let's ask what we're doing, and let's also ask, of course, what provinces are doing. Remember, of the 153 billion or so, we get a relatively small slice of that. Of that slice that we get, with the 17 or 18 billion or so, about 80% of that goes direct and transfers to universities. So actually, we're left with a relatively small little slice to do a large amount of things. So there has to be a collective, I suppose, approach on it. But certainly, your questions, I think, are well placed. And as I say, we have been either doing the wrong things or doing the right things, but not sufficiently. Then I think there needs to be engagement specifically about that. And let's relook at that strategic plan and let's ask ourselves, are there things that we don't need to do? Are there things we need to do more of? Certainly, that, I think, discussion has come up, but as I say, we have worked, I think, largely under the political mandate that has been given to us, and that's how that can be modeled. Chair, just to have on some of the more specific ones then. On the similarity, I think your co-chair has, of course, picked up a critical issue. We have identified these 500 schools as deserving of special attention. They qualified to become dinner lady schools through a number of factors. One of them, at least, is that they have a sufficient number of learners doing mathematics at these schools. You use the word choices, Chair, and regrettably, I think we do need to make choices. And perhaps that's, again, a political debate. You can either say, yes, we'll take all 6,000 secondary schools and we'll try and build them all up to a sufficient level, but perhaps it's going to take us 20 years to do it, and until we get there, you know, there's nothing more we can do. Or do we say, hold on, here's some schools who seem to be turning, as you say, the resources into outcomes. Shouldn't we rather invest a bit more money in these schools now, get these ones working at least, and then more and more increase them? Now, I think it's a big issue because not just around the Naledi, our minister has asked us to look at other specialist schools, schools of art, drama, dance. You know, should we be investing particular money? And let's understand these tend to be very expensive schools. You need you know, large numbers, well-trained teachers, etc. So I suppose that whole debate about whether we identify specialist schools or specialist attention, as it were, or do we take a more general approach and try slowly to uplift everyone, I think is a political choice that has to be made. We have been guided to say these choices at the moment are that if you do identify these schools, we do give them special attention, and hopefully as a result of that, we get at least some of the outcomes that we would be looking at. So that is one on Dimaledi. But you're right, the goal in the middle term has to be to try and bring every school up to that kind of level. That's right. But how you get there, I think, is perhaps a matter of strategy and action that we would want to find. Chair, on the NS Fund, certainly on an annual basis, they do table their report in Parliament, so it would be available to you to see. They talk about the funding that they have received, the funding they've used. They will indicate there the students they have supported. Let me be quite clear. There is a means test in order to qualify for an NS Fund. So if anyone is aware of a student who they believe could afford those fees and might have gotten NS Fund grant, please let us know. Basically, it's fraud. It means someone has lied on their means test, and we need to investigate that. Similarly, I would say if any deserving student who can genuinely not afford their fees is not getting an NS Fund grant, then we also need to take it up and find out why not. As the GFO said, there's over 2 billion rand now on an annual basis going into those bursaries and loans. If we make sure that it gets to the right people and, as I say, deserving students, then certainly I believe there should not be a poor student who is excluded from higher education, certainly if they qualify in other tests for that. The no-fee school, I'm happy to say that in the last 2 weeks, we have finally gazetted a revised set of norms and standards around school funding, and those norms provide that the school allocation shall be made in two tranches, and the first one shall be made in November of the current year in order to provide them for money at the start of the next year. So that now is gazetted. It is now a policy. Provinces will be obliged to follow that. And let's say once again, Chair, as elected representative, if you're aware of a school that comes to closure in September, has not received its allocation for the coming year, please let us know. We will certainly intervene directly. Again, it's not our allocation, it's from the province, but we would certainly demand an explanation from the province as to why that is not. So please, again, we're inviting you to please provide that oversight, and if we have slipped up, we must be able to account. Some of the other issues you raised, Co-Chair, from the Collective Mission on Finance, the transport one, I must say, is still not finally resolved. We as the Department of Education are adamant. We believe this should be a function that the department delivers. We believe we know who the students are and who needs to be aware and what that would involve. The Department of Transport does make an argument to say that this needs to be part of a broader public transport system. And in some ways, they have a tenable argument that says if there's a bus going past a group of people, you don't pick up some of the people and then say, no, you children would wait for the school bus, which is different. If there's a public bus, you use a public bus and let's do it. So there needs to be, I think, in a sense, it's not an either or. I think there has to be involvement by both. I'm happy to say that in many provinces now, there is an understanding worked out between the two, where essentially the Department of Transport might have the money, but the Department of Education is saying, these are the learners being transported from here to there on these particular days, and we would certainly do that. I think, you know, it's true to say we haven't yet sufficiently budgeted for that transport, and that's why you do foresee individuals walking, and
I'm not even sure that it's a particular problem for the rural areas. I think it's been pointed out even in the urban areas. 5 kilometers in the rural area is sometimes different from 5 kilometers to the middle of town. You know, so I think those issues are certainly there, and we will continue to look at that. Of course, the Department of Transport is also exploring issues of the shorter footed bicycles and those sort of things, which are obviously need to look at. Yeah, I think that is just a challenge we'll have to continue to work with. We are in discussion between the two ministers and the MDGs, respectively, around trying to finalize that particular issue. On the issue of the FET College recap, and let me just clarify, it's not the department that got the conditional grant, it was a 3-year conditional grant, so it's run as planned in a sense. We haven't even monitored this incredibly, so to speak. Remember, we've only got EFTA. Well, it was a 3-year conditional grant, so it ran for 3 years, and now the grant has ended. So it's not as if we said it should end. In fact, we've gone further, and we've prepared now an intergovernmental protocol in terms of the IGFR with provinces, not in respect of the recap money, but broadly in respect of FET College simple maintenance money. We want to be sure that those colleges now do not get underfunded. So without saying they become a national responsibility, we are signing a protocol with provinces to ensure that those funding streams continue for our FET colleges. We can share that with you. I think it's quite an innovative step in government and one that we hope is able to secure the ongoing funding of these FET colleges. But as regards to recap, certainly, as I say, there's only 50 colleges, so they've been a very close sector, and we haven't monitored those very tightly. And I would invite you, quite honestly, to visit any of my FET colleges, Minister of Indiza in Newcastle the other day, visiting the Majuba FET College. I have to say, if you want to see skills development going on, go and visit one of those colleges. Now, you know, the recap was a part for new building, but as much as anything, it was about refurbishing what was in there, the equipment, the machinery, and all of that, make sure it's updated. I think we do have, in most cases, very modern now FET colleges, and broadly they have been recapitalized in a way that enables them now to significantly increase their enrollment. We are targeting 1 million learners in our FET colleges. At the moment, of course, we've got about 300,000 learners, so massive room for growth in those colleges. The recap has kept them up in a position to do that, although we sometimes have to remind them that classes don't just happen between 8 and 1. An FET college actually should be a 24/7 operation. This is not something, you know, historically the technical colleges, you know, you worked there a bit and then lunchtime you went home sort of thing. That's not the nature of it now. You after hours, part-time, Saturdays, whatever it is, but we really should have more students in our FET colleges than our universities. So please go and visit some of these FET colleges. Again, if you find something of it, let us know. But the colleges have been very closely watched in terms of the use of this recap money. And let me say, before the grant is ending mid-year this year, where any college was not utilizing all its funds, we have also enabled provinces to shift between them to make sure that funds do get used and used in purposes that were intended. So that, I think, is certainly one of the steps we can take, and I hope that anything would clarify that. The Honourable Mashenko spoke about NOP schools, and we have this continual issue of the determination of quintiles. Now, I can say, Chair, that the department is, in a sense, rethinking its model and whether we do need these 5 quintiles, given that perhaps some 60% of our schools now are going to be moving into a no-fee status, whether we should be distinguishing between them, whether a quintile 1 is really more or less deserving than a quintile 2, is an issue that I think is under discussion. And it might well be that all your no-fee schools are simply regarded as one group and your fee schools are regarded as another. So there is some discussion around that. But let us be quite clear again. The determination of quintiles in the current system is based on your census data, and it relates to the area in which the school is located. So there should be no reason why schools next door to each other in the same area serving the same community are placed in different quintiles. Again, if that is the situation, let's find out, and of course there's a reason the province why they have allocated that. It could be, of course, that some schools, you know, might be in a better condition, so we have allowed the MET's in the province to readjust that quintile allocation. So perhaps this whole area, all schools in this area are quintile 2, but remember, in any quintile, any ranking system, someone has to be at the top, someone has to be at the bottom, and you do allow the MET the discretion to move that around, and that is based on the contestation from a school. So again, if there is a school that feels it is wrongly allocated in terms of the quintiles, it must contest that in front of the field to the MET to ask A, for the reasons why it was given that particular ranking, and B, more importantly, whether it can be moved. Of course, understand the MET's challenge. If one school moves down in the ranking and therefore gets more money, some other school has to move up in the ranking. And that's not a popular thing now. It's a bit of an irony with the schools competing to be poorer than the other one, but that is the way it works. But certainly, as I say, there should be no reason why schools in the same area aren't ranking in quintile, let's push the MECs on that and try and understand them. The question of the relating one around the transport, etc. I come to notice in the Sunday newspaper this week, the Pope had a whole full page advertisement on the mergers of schools. We've been encouraging provinces to do this. You know, if you looked at the numbers in some of those schools, it was 20, 30 children in a school. Now, with respect, it's not economically efficient, but more than that, it's not educationally efficient to have a school with that sort of number. So Free State, you will see, has done a lot of consolidating of these smaller schools, bringing them in. They've gone for a boarding option in most cases. They actually bring the children into a centre and they provide a boarding facility there. And let's say whatever one might or might not believe about boarding schools, etc., the fact is those children are getting 3 teaching meals a day, they're getting supervised homework in the evening, face-to-face to sleep, etc., and generally they're transported home at the weekend. I have no doubt it's beneficial. So we're encouraging that, and you'll notice, I think, in that Limpopo advert, the commitment they made, any child who has more than 5 kilometres as a result of these mergers, they will provide transport for it. We need to simply hold people accountable for that. I agree with you around the 5 kilometres, let's see if we can reduce it, but at the moment, at least, that is the commitment, and certainly, as I say, we would want to encourage, I think, that. So I think this issue of children might be in a primary school, but not high school, we really need to see what the province is. Arrangements are around that. Every child needs to make sure that they do get access. You know, we are making the point now, and Minister said it more than once, although the Constitution talks about your inalienable right to a basic education, we have a very clear understanding of basic education in 12 years. There should be nothing less than that. So we want to respect that. Okay, in relation to the learners under trees, I will ask Mr. Patel to comment on that, but I do believe we have largely addressed that, and perhaps he will talk also to the briefing from the HSRC. I think with respect here, they are using our data, so that's come from our electronic information management system, but we'll talk about what has been done in that regard and indeed what has been done. Let me just end with the issue of the school nutrition program. The current funding allows us to feed all learners in quintiles 1, 2, and 3 in primary schools. That's calculated at the figure of R1.50 a day. Now, with respect to you, to go out and spend R1.50 a day, just think about the lunch that you would have eaten before that. Obviously, buying in bulk can help a little bit, but in the end, it is not a large amount, and therefore there are challenges there. But we are committed to feeding on all school days all quintile 1, 2, and 3 learners in primary schools. Some provinces have, of their own accord, added funding to this National Conditional Grant, and they have now included some secondary school learners. They've also included some poor learners in quintile 4 and 5 schools, but that's a little bit complicated. There is a social problem where you identify specific learners and feed them and then not others. There tends to be a bit of a status thing in the school that becomes an issue, but some provinces have certainly chosen to do that. The bid that we've put in is asking us that we go into quintile 1, 2, and 3 secondary schools and that we increase the feeding amount to R2 per day, and that's what we're requesting, and as has been indicated in the presentation, we have had additional R4 billion. It's not as much as we asked for, but certainly we will be wanting to look there again and see what we can do. There are questions, and maybe this is part of the reason it was raised, around the approaches. It's a bit like your LTSM delivery. Some provinces have gone for a single big agency. They just do a one-off payment to that agency, and that agency just covers all schools for the car. Other provinces, like this one in particular, Western Cape, have said, no, we've gone for a decentralized model. We give schools the money, and they go out and they buy it at the local bookshop. You know, there are arguments obviously in favor of both, but there are particularly arguments around SMME development on the latter one. In a sense, the same thing with our school fees. Some provinces have just said, one big contractor, he drives past with a truck and he drops off the loaves of bread and whatever else and keeps moving. Well, there's an efficiency gain there, and probably there's a bit of a cost efficiency as well. But of course, our design model is far more around the food garden at the school, and we've got some 6,000 schools now that have developed food gardens. And then, of course, through a local cooperative model, to get your local mothers involved, feeding, cooking, that kind of thing, using local lead supplies as well. There's a risk there. In the Eastern Cape, we had evidence of what they were referring to as Hong Kong bread, local bread baked at a local bakery standard that certainly would not be acceptable anymore. So we continually got that trade-off. You know, do we just go for the big bakers and say, all right, it's your job and you get a multi-million rand tender, or do we break it up into little communities and try and allocate here? Again, issues. But let me just say, appeal once again, if you're visiting a school, if it's a quintile 1-2-3 primary school, if it's not feeding, or if you think that the quality of food is not ideal, please let us know. Our job is indeed to monitor that. We will certainly pick it up with the provincial department. Can I ask Mr. Patel just to deal with the... Okay, Mr.
Bernardi first, and then Mr. Patel. Thank you, Richard. I just want to add a small thing to the issue around allocations to schools where the funding is not flowing from the provincial office to the school. We have been investigating a number of such issues. Now, what we just need to keep in mind is that in some cases, the schools are a little bit naughty. Because in terms of the PFMA and the Treasury regulation, it is clear that if you make a transfer payment in 1 year, before you can do it for next year, the recipient must come back and indicate that the money was utilized correctly and for the purpose it was intended. And we found in most cases where schools were complaining that they had not received their new allocation, that they had not complied with reporting back on the previous year's allocation. So if a school indicates to any honourable member that they have not received, have just asked them that question, but have you complied with the conditions of reporting back so that you do qualify for the new subsidy for the new year?
Thank you, Didi. Just as a correction on that policy, the Minister's signed it off this week. It's going to be appearing in a government gazette on Friday this week. So the issue of the two tranches of payment, we're encouraging at least one, at most one tranche, but some provinces may have difficulties. So therefore, 15th of November to carry you up until the 15th of May, and then 15th of May to carry you up to November again. So that's clearly going to be in policy, and we hope to monitor that particular area. Okay, you raised the issue, and I think I want to speak on the issue of infrastructure. In the context of the HSRC report, toilets, learners on the train, yes, I think we do not dispute those particular figures. For example, our own figures tell us that 12.6% of schools do not have a source of water on the site. 6% do not have toilets on site. 30% have more than 50 learners per toilet. So basically, I can go down this particular list. But what is important is that has there been an improvement since 1996? Then yes, the number of overcrowded schools has fallen from 51%. In 1996 to 24% in 2006. The number of schools with electric facilities has increased from 11,000 to 21,000. The number of schools without water has decreased from 8,800 to 3,152 in 2006. And the number of schools without toilets has decreased from 3,265 in 1996 to 1,532 in 2006. So there has been progress, However, one school without water, one school without toilet is one school too much. We have calculated, in terms of the National Education Information Management System, that in order to deal with the backlogs, just to be able to deal with the backlogs, both in terms of conditions, so for example in schools where either they mud schools or the conditions are not conducive, as well as sufficient space to be able to deal with those particular backlogs, including maintenance, at the minimum level of maintenance in terms of the industry standards, we would require 233 billion rand. Now, 233 billion rand, if we spread that over a 10-year period, starting, say, 2010 to 2020, and we say in that 10 years we deal with our backlog, our current budgets are 80 billion rand over that particular period in nominal terms. That really means that we will require something like about 233 billion rand. Obviously, as the DG has indicated, at our current level, we're not going to be able to reach it. However, there are both steps that are particularly required. We have to have a concerted effort in terms of able to deal with it. And the issue is it's a collective decision that has to be made. If we say that it's the right thing to do, then we will have to do it now. I'm not the person that deals with the financial modalities, but clearly, logic tells us that we're not going to be able to carry it on the budget. So there has to be other means to be able to find it. I'm not sure what those means are.
I'm sorry, sir. I don't know. Maybe other colleagues do understand what Mr. Sabrina is saying, but for me, I don't. I really don't. I would want to understand. The saying that over 10 days, I mean, the budget for the first law would be 12 or something billion. And then you're saying that now you can't afford that. We really don't understand what you're trying to say. What's for that?
Yes, Honorable Dumeni, and then we will allow you.
With due respect, my question was, let me just mention the few minimum standards in terms of the mutual particular standards. Number 3, human resources. Number 4, plan. Number 5, budget. These are the 5 key words in my question. And the rest
it's just clarify some other misunderstandings. Yes, Honourable Fina.
No, Chair, just when I asked about the schools without sanitation and water, I asked a specific question as to how this budget of the MTF is going to be used to eradicate that backlog. So I would appreciate that we could get that specification as well. Thank you.
Look, you know the thing is that we really have to get from you perhaps a little bit of fine tuning. You may not be able to do this instant, but you know, what is the reality over the 3 years? And for me, you know, the issue would be water is essential. Essential. And it cuts the health problems as well. Let's not talk about, you know, I said at the beginning, let's avoid denial, let's avoid trying to say, you know, I'm never going to be able to do this. So don't even ask me to, because it's impossible. Look at the figures. Because if we go that route, we would never have gotten to the revolution. I really think that what you're doing is not being constructive. What I want is for you to be constructive and just answer these questions on the table. Don't tell me you don't know, you're not in the budget. You're in the department, and give us some genuine, realistic responses. If you can't, tell us straight that you're going to give them to us in writing tomorrow.
can you tell people out there what Mr. Sassen is saying that, look, this is a matter of the deadlock that you have. There's nothing that you can do about it. Then vote for us. Can you tell the people that?
So our question depends about Mr. John, and I think he was still coming to the point of the solutions, all right? He was outlining the problem as it stands, and what he was saying is that based on a very accurate survey we've done, there's a significant amount of money that is needed. Indicated definitely what is in the budget over the MTF period, and clearly there's a gap between the two, and I think he would now be able to indicate what therefore needs to be done around the bridging that gap.
Let's hand over to you, Mr. Patel, and just a light note. We won't talk about cutting down the trees so they know no one's studying unpacking. Let's just now, we all relax and we get a few answers.
Thank you, Chief. But let me say that infrastructure budgets move via the National Treasury by an infrastructure grant. So this department has almost no control over the issue of allocations in terms of infrastructure grants. They are on the provincial budget from National Treasury. However, we do deal with the issue of monitoring and evaluation. The Council of Education Ministers has just in its last meeting for the first time approved draft national norms and standards in regards to school infrastructure. That is school types and school sizes, minimum requirements in terms of toilet, minimum requirements in terms of the classroom size, etc. Now taking those particular norms into account, Chair, what I was pointing out is that if we take the information that is available, clearly the issue is that if we set ourselves a target, and that's what I was coming to, is that we are going to be, the Council of Education Minister have said that in terms of the 10-year plan that we have calculated in terms of eradicating the backlog, around the 233 billion rand required from 2010 to 2020, that the education sector will be able to eradicate the backlog. However, as I indicated, the funding issues aside, that's not the particular difficulty. Clearly, the issue is untenable, and we require this particular plan, and we're hoping that Cabinet will provide the specific approval in terms of the strategy, and then we can begin to look at the funding. So, in a nutshell, what I'm saying is that those standards have been developed, they will be published for public comment, together with a proposal to National Treasury for the establishment of a national unit for the coordination and support of school infrastructure. We've also in discussions with National Treasury in terms of the IDEP program that they're working with provinces. Chair, I will pause there. In terms of the water and sanitation, Duarte has been granted the 950 million rand over a 3-year period to be able to deal with the elimination of water. The current funding in provinces... The elimination of the shortage of water. Yeah. Apologies for that. The issue is dealing with... Duarte has been allocated 950 rand in the 2008 budget. We have a 3-year plan, but we're not going to be able to deal with all the backlogs within that particular 3 years in terms of those funds available. However, in the medium-term budget policy statement, additional funds have been allocated from 2010 onward to deal with the armed infrastructure as well as safety and security in schools, libraries, and laboratories. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Just because we do have a time constraint, but let's pose just a couple of questions for your response in writing to us, not next week, but because we know you have all this information, it's a matter of getting a typist on board. So they have to send it to us tomorrow afternoon. So it's just a matter of getting it on paper, as it were. Now, so we'll just close these three. My co-chair just wants to raise one point, which will be responded to in writing. The second point is so that the department can explain whether in meeting these challenges as you outline, particularly with respect to the minimum standards and the infrastructure, whether the provincial departments, you are confident that they'll be able to implement them. And thirdly, as you indicated, DWOP are now over a 3-year period. They also feel strongly about the water. The DWOP over a 3-year period are going to eliminate the lack of water in the schools and the sanitation, as I understood you. We want that clear. In this response, make your response in writing clear to us, because we don't want to go into the house and publicly mislead the nation. But I think that those three points are very clear plus the point that my co-chair will raise.
annual report.
are published by the department, and if we could have that tomorrow afternoon back, and if not tomorrow afternoon, the following morning, and our committee secretary, Mr. will be following that up with you. Now, I'd like to thank the department for being here very early, coming the previous day. It does show respect, to honour the engagement, and we appreciate that. And so, given that track record, that we know you'll be able to respond in writing equally efficiently. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming here this morning to engage with us. Now, honourable members, we're running a little bit behind because we started 15 minutes late. We are going to be able to make up time because we're going to have what is called a working lunch. We all know what working lunch is. So it's a matter of a 5 minute comfort break. And then bring your tea in and we'll carry on with the meeting. It's 10:30. We'll carry on no later than 10:40. In other words, we'll start as if you're not back. Thank you.
In terms of the focus areas of the presentation, they cover 6 areas. These are the areas that you are looking at in the letter that the department has gone from the committee. It's an outline of the medium term sector and departmental policy priorities for 2008-2009. An outline of progress that we made for achievement of the objectives and the targets, also linked to the Millennium Development Goals. Thirdly, the medium-term expenditure trends within the sector, including some of the projections, allocations, as announced in the MPPPA. We will also focus on the departmental budgets that were not funded for the 2009-2010 budget cycle. We'll then talk briefly about some of the budget challenges, financing challenges, and some of the unfunded mandates. Really speak to the challenges in terms of the fiscal and the fixed and medium-term sector and development and departmental priorities, there are 8 of them. which were selected by the minister in the MEC in a structure that we have called the National Health Council. And these are sector-wide priorities, not for the national priorities. They are following strengthening health programs, and by health programs we mean TB, HIV and AIDS, the general and child health, and the risk of the development and improvement, implementation of health facility improvement plans. This is our flagship quality assurance program. The development of an integrated health information system, strengthening budgeting and planning, especially health finance. Achieving further targets in the types of medicines and pharmaceutical products, and human resources for health. One of the key functions of the National Department is international health relations, and finally, improving management and communication within the National Health. These priorities are reflected in our annual national health plan, which is compiled jointly with the provinces, and therefore reflect the priorities of the entire. The progress towards achieving these objectives. The priority one was strengthening health programs. With respect to maternal child and women's health and nutrition, we're following some of the key achievements, and these are consistent with MDG goals 4 and 5, which are child health, reducing child mortality, and reducing maternal mortality. Although the surplus and number of them, I think the one caveat is that the department does many, many things. And in the short time we have to present, we're just highlighting a few of the things that we've achieved. So the annual report is much more elaborate in terms of covering all the things we do. We have, during the last 6 months or so, reviewed our strategic plan for maternal child and women's health. And we have drafted a new strategic plan for the next 5 years. Based on our experiences in the past 5 years. It's very exciting to note that our immunization coverage, that is, children under 1 who are fully immunized, will reach a coverage of 88% in 2008, which is today. And this contributes to us protecting children against vaccine preventable disease. Honorable members will know that the former Minister of Health launched in September 2 new vaccines, one for diarrhea and another for pneumonia, which are the result of a virus, and we are in the process of rolling that out nationally. We want to achieve 90% coverage of children fully immunized in each district, and we are providing targeted support to districts to achieve this. Through what's called the WED strategy, which is the Reach Every District strategy. Currently, 27 of our 52 districts are implementing the Reach Every District strategy. As I said, funding has been obtained from National Treasury to introduce 2 new vaccines. These are Prevnar and Rotavirus. And this will be expanded, rolled out. The initial launch was in Bukhasamba in Eastern Cape, and it will be rolled out nationally. The department is also on target to ensure that all our facilities that deliver babies are baby friendly. A total of 554 clinics, community health centers, and hospitals with maternity beds have been targeted, and of these, about half, 232, are currently declared baby friendly. The baby friendly status is the status allocated using criteria designed by UNICEF. So it's an external measure of quality. The next slide talks about HIV and AIDS largely, and this is consistent with goal 6 of the MDG. Honorable members will know that we have adopted and have been implementing over the last 18 months or so a comprehensive plan for HIV and AIDS care management. And this is not just a health sector strategy, but it's an intersectoral strategy. The significant component of this that falls directly in the ambit of the health sector is called a comprehensive plan, which focuses really on the treatment and prevention side of health. best prevention, the number of activities that take place to ensure that we prevent the transmission of HIV. More than 90% of public health facilities currently provide voluntary counseling and testing and prevention of mother to child transmission. Over 80 million male condoms were distributed in the first quarter of 2008-2009. And clearly, we need to build up fairly rapidly towards our target of 450 million for this financial year. In quarter one, a total of 1.2 million female condoms were also distributed against the target for the year of 3.5 million. The reason why there's such a dramatic difference between male condoms and female condoms is largely around the price. And we currently are developing specifications for a synthetic latex-based female condom, which will be cheaper than the current polyurethane female condom. By the end of July 2008, a total of 554,603 patients have been initiated on antiretroviral therapy, of which 495,002 were adults and just under 50,000. These will exceed the targets in the National Strategic Plan for OAIDS children. In terms of antenatal care, the antenatal care survey on HIV prevalence in women attending public health systems reflects a 1% reduction in HIV prevalence between 2006 and 2006. And a 2% reduction between 2005 and 2006. So we think that certainly our prevention strategies seem to be making some difference with respect to women in public health. With respect to tuberculosis, which is really consistent with goal 6 of the MDGs, we are recording marginal improvements in our TB cure. Honorable Chairperson, the reason why we aren't able to provide 07 or 08 data is because it takes a whole year for us to get cured in terms of following the course and fully completing. So the latest figure then is for 2006. And as we can see, that it's a fixed and improvement over 2005. We have some data for 2007 which suggests a cure rate. So we think we're moving in the right direction. But it's way below our target of 85%. That's the target that we set up for the next 5 years. In order to improve the TB cure rate, we need to strengthen the TB control program. And one way to do that is to decrease the default rate. People start treatment but don't complete for one reason or another. We have, in February this year, established 72 TB tracer teams composed of community health workers and retired nurses to follow patients who we know have defaulted and to get them back on TB. To date, we have found more than 90% of these patients and more than 63% of them have been initiated. Our estimate at present is that our current TB defaulter rate is 8.6%, and it's moved from 10%, which has decreased successfully for some years. So we're moving, okay, slowly, but in the right direction towards our target of lower than 7% support. In terms of TB-HIV, more than 80% of patients who present to health facilities, certainly in the first half of 2008, were tested for HIV because of the high rate of co-infection in our TB, which runs between 30 and 50. I think honorable members will know that we have a number of cases of multiple drug-resistant TB, as well as extremely drug-resistant TB. We have trained clinicians in the management of these strains of TB. We make drugs available. And for drug-resistant TB, our policy is isolation in public health facilities. The key, though, to drug-resistant TB is to ensure that the national TB program is well-run, and therefore means a significant reduction in use. With respect to malaria control, we have, over the last 4 or 5 years, done very well in reducing both the number of cases of malaria and the fatality from malaria. However, this year there was a slight uptick in the number of cases of malaria in focal problem. And due at least in part to cross-border movement of patients from along the Bay Bridge corridor. However, it's very fine to note that many of them are being picked up and initiated from treatment. We are currently looking at working more closely with our colleagues in the south of Zimbabwe to ensure that the malaria control program in Zimbabwe is also strengthened. With respect to the Healthy Lifestyles program, we won't repeat what we've said before in terms of the Look for Health, Rural South Africa Look for Health program. Just to report that to date, in this financial year, we have an additional 10 community-based food garden projects, building on the 36 that have been established in the Australian Acres in the Eastern Cape. These honorable chairpersons do not include those that are established by province, by the provincial department. These have been initiated by the national ministry. With respect to non-communicable diseases, I think it's fair to say that we have an increasing burden of disease from non-communicable diseases, and this is consistent with what's happening in many, many developing countries, and we are fast catching up with the rates of development. We have guidelines on the management of non-communicable diseases. We have improved access to people with disabilities to our health facilities. And one marker that we use to monitor is the average waiting time for wheelchairs. And this is between 8 and 10 weeks currently. So the target is to reduce it below 8. With respect to priority areas, policy improvement, honorable members may know that in April this year, the National Department launched a national core standard for health systems, public health systems, structured around 7 key domains. These being patient safety, clinical care, governance and management, patient experience of care, access to care, infrastructure and environment, and public health. And these focus really on how the health facilities respond.
With respect, I'm not sure if the communication that you received was clear in terms of what the objectives of this meeting are. Maybe I did not, but because I explained to you myself as well at the beginning. But this is a joint budget committee, which is today wishing to listen to the. You have requested some additional funds. Would really request that your report today could assist us in terms of saying, should the committee perhaps approve your additional files or adjustments that you need to request in. So we see the report that to me seems to be a very general report. Perhaps later on is going to assist us. But part of this is really to say from your general report, it doesn't tell us any challenges or what, but it would be useful for if you can touch on those things, we see the general report that you hear. But also what we are interested in are those things that you're not telling us, but all of us are aware that are taking place, and what is it that you're doing about them. Please, if you can just zoom on those kinds of things, and I hope that your CFO as well specifically to
so, with your permission, we can skip much of what I was going to say on the achievement, but we were speaking really to bullet points number two of the letter. We can skip it just to honorable members. And I'll focus on just one slide and then hand over to the CFO to talk about the medium term expenditure with your permission.
The challenges would be the main concern here in this area, even on the number two. When we talk about progress, yes, but what are the challenges there? You see, we're really had to work together to actually make more progress. We want our country to be. So it's not going to help us by the broad we've all read the annual report.
Yeah, an annual report is very, very serious challenge.
Your own annual report. How are you changing it?
Okay, we'll be happy to talk about that. I guess we interpret the progress to be achievement, not the challenge. But we're quite happy to talk about the challenge as well, which, of course, as honorable members know, there are many, many around. So maybe I should maybe then list out the cost-cutting challenges rather than speak to them underneath of the honorable chairs. Wouldn't mind.
Now, I think that maybe we really not intend to disorganize the union or in your presentation, but you can present as much as you can. You have seen a lot of people to present so that you can give us as much information as possible to the people in terms of what happened.
Improvements in terms increasing the supporter rate and increasing insurance, but we have still a long way to go towards our 85% coverage in terms of insurance. What are the budget questions there? Again, it's human resources in terms of nurses. In terms of expanding the TB reported team, there will also be payments to community health workers to do this work. Unfortunately, in the context in which many of our community health workers find themselves, it's difficult for them to volunteer without at least getting some form of stipend. So there's another budget question there. The additional budget question has been on the multiple and extensively drug-resistant TB. We were thankful that we got a sum of 400 million rand in 2007-2008 for national failures and some funding throughout the NTF period for multiple and extensively drug-resistant TB. Lastly, around the provision of infrastructure and some staffing and drugs to help these patients in our TB. And of course, that's a continuing problem. But as we find more of these patients, we need to find wards to keep them, which means needing to create more and more wards to house our patients. So there's significant budget pressures on that side. The third one that I'll speak about is maternal and child health, because it relates to the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals. Our current estimate of infant mortality is 45-46 per 1,000 lives. However, that's our estimate from 2003. We are currently in the process of doing the field work to collect data for 2008, because this survey is done every 5 years. So we don't know now, 5 years on, yet, what our infant mortality is. We will know in about 6 months. There are some indications that it's going up. There are others that it's stable, which means that we are not making any progress in terms of decreasing infant mortality. The question is, how do you increase infant mortality? One is obviously to improve and expand our prevention of mother-to-child transmission program, which means preventing the transmission of the HIV virus from mother to child. And we are in the process of strengthening that program. Again, in some places, we'll need more resources. The second will be the vaccine preventable diseases that we spoke about already, and that is to improve our vaccine immunization coverage and to introduce new vaccines, which we are currently doing. And again, in terms of the new vaccines, we'll need some additional funding. Thirdly, clearly there are the social determinants of health that impact significantly on individual health. The two key things, well, the three key things. One is the education level of mothers. And that's the single best indicator of infant mortality. The more highly educated mothers are, the less likely it is that the kids will die. Second is access to clean water and sanitation. So to the extent that we expand access to clean water and sanitation in the country, is the extent to which we will also contribute to decreasing infant mortality. And of course, these are things outside of the direct purview of the health system, but it's an issue for government as a whole. And I think on that score, in terms of access to water and sanitation, we have made significant progress in the last 14 years. But there are still areas that have inadequate access. With respect to maternal mortality, in 1998, we estimated that maternal mortality was 150 maternal deaths per 100,000 deliveries. So infant mortality is per 1,000 deliveries, but maternal mortality is denominated around 100,000. In 2004, Death South Africa, using death-specific information, estimated that it was about 124. However, other people, including the MRC, have suggested it might be about double that. So in the market, it's 200. Our South African Demographic and Health Survey, which we are, as I said, collecting information now, more definitively what it is. So we have a challenge in terms of health information with respect to some of our mortality. So that's really, and of course, to change maternal mortality, we need to ensure, one, that our fertility rate goes down. Right? And that, of course, again, is beyond the health sector, but our reproductive health programs in terms of contraception. And access to contraception is quite good in this country. But there are some areas where it can be improved. So it's in the 90%. Secondly, we need to ensure that when a woman are pregnant, that they seek antenatal care as quickly as possible, which means making sure that services are as close to people as possible. And it means, therefore, that antenatal services should be arranged at primary health care, the clinics that are closest. But we know that not everyone lives within a 5-kilometer radius of that, which means we need to extend our services via mobile services and, again, by employing community health workers. Thirdly, once pregnant women attend our facilities, we must ensure that we have skilled and adequately staffed facilities to render the antenatal services to our patients. And again, that requires a set of infrastructure and human resources. The other key challenge, of course, is in instances of obstetric emergencies where women have difficult pregnancies. We want to ensure that they are able to access services as quickly as possible, which means that our emergency medical services, our ambulance services, need to really reach everyone as quickly as possible. We have a benchmark of 30 minutes in urban areas and 45 minutes in rural areas. But honorable chairpersons and members, we are not really anywhere close to achieving that, even though we have purchased many, many more ambulances and have trained significant numbers of ambulance personnel in the last 10 years. We are not anywhere close to that. I would guess that even in the metro, in some areas, we struggle to meet the 30 minutes. So there's a range of interventions necessary in the health system to decrease the number of challenges. Just to give you a flavor of the complexity and the fact that there's a continuum of care from the family to the community and to the health system. With respect to improving quality of care, as I said, we have these national core standards that we launched in April. We have assessed 27 hospitals, at least one in each province to date, and we have found a number of good practices, even in the context of scarce resources, but we have also found challenges. And some of these challenges are management challenges, and therefore will need improved management practices. But there are a number that also need additional resources. For example, one of our challenges in many of our facilities is poor infection control. Now, especially when you have an airborne disease like TB, you want to ensure that all your facilities have very good airborne infection control. So in your outpatient department, in the casualty, in the medical ward, you want to ensure that you have good airflow, extractor fans, and all of that. Many of our facilities were built long before we had drug resistance and before we had the large numbers of TB patients currently, and certainly before we've had the co-infection of HIV. So we need a fair amount of additional resources to improve the infrastructure in our health facilities with respect to infection control. So I'm giving you a flavor, not the full basket, but the CFO will talk about it. With respect to an integrated national health information system, currently, besides the surveys that we do, which are every 3 to 5 years, we have one routine health system, which is an activity-based health system, which collects information in an aggregate function from clinics upwards, and it's called the district health information. We do not have a national electronic patient record. The implication of this, honorable chairperson and members, is that we cannot follow a patient using a medical record from one facility to another easily, but more importantly, from one city to another and one province to another. So there's no national electronic patient record. So that would require huge amounts of funding. And again, we can speak to the additional funding requested and what the state. With respect to human resources, and I'll just stick to that so that I can give the CFO some time to speak to the numbers. Over the last 3 years, we have seen an increase of some 30,000 new personnel in the health system, of which 8,000 are nurses. least in part contributed to the additional funding we had for human resources and more recently to the occupation-specific dispensation. However, I think most of us would have read the Business Day of yesterday and the editorial today, there is still a huge shortage of all categories of human resources in the house, calculated at over 30,000. And of course, that means significant upswing in the budget that would be required to pay these people to begin. And the CFO will talk to you. So I'll skip then, having given a flavor of some of the budget things, to the slide that suggests what we put funding for, priority four. And then I'll hand over to the CFO to talk about some of the numbers. So in line with some of the budget questions, then, there are a number of areas we could get some additional funding for, both in the adjustment budget and in the 09-10 budget. And those are listed in this slide. I'll just read them out and not speak to them. One is to provide additional funding for the occupation specific dispensation, both for nurses and then the other categories that we propose following the line. Secondly, the introduction of the two new vaccines for diarrhea and pneumonia to decrease incidence in child mortality. Thirdly, to implement the community and household component of the integrated management of child illness, which is again a program targeted at reducing infant child care. Fourthly, to implement the National Health Quality Improvement Program, which relates to the four standards of quality. Firstly, to strengthen the health information system, specific emphasis on the electronic health record. Sixth, is to improve our emergency medical services, and this is not just for 2010, but includes preparing for 2010. Seventh, is to strengthen the TB control and management program, and I've already spoken at length why we need to do that. Sixth, is to strengthen the existing national tertiary services to improve resource allocation, and the CFO will speak a little bit about that. The next is to improve the allocation of the health professionals' training and development grant. The next is to expand the comprehensive plan reach for HIV and AIDS, especially with respect to additional funding required for the first distribution of drugs. And finally, to improve the infrastructure for hospitals in terms of expanding the hospital revitalization program. And finally, to improve the service delivery at primary health care, which is clinics and large. I'll hand over now the opposition coaches to the CFO to say what happened to this budget.
Honourable members, if we look at this slide in front of us and move from there forward, I think we can cover most of the items raised by the co-chair. Firstly, just to give some sort of a synopsis of what happened at the end of last financial year. There was an overrun in the sector, and at this point in time, I'm going to talk about the health sector totally, which means the provinces largely. It was the overrun of the human resource expenditure, which amounted to 1.6 billion. That, if we look at that and we break it down, we estimate that approximately 800 million was due to the OSD, the occupation specific dispensation, and the other was due to the balance, which is also 800 million, was due to additional staff. Then there was an overrun on non-HR, non-capital expenditure, which amounted to 0.6 billion. Honorable chairs, honorable members, this item buys items such as medicine, surgical requirements like vending systems and so forth, and then also fuel, and particularly also coal. We tend to forget about coal, because every hospital has a boiler which generates the steam that's required in a hospital, which is again required for sterilizing and other functions. The health sector underspent their capex by approximately 1 billion, and that comes largely from the hospital revitalization program and the mortuary
made the overrun 1.4 billion. Now, as regards the, if we can turn the page, as regards the adjustment budget, the department submitted three specific bids for the adjustment budget. The first one is for the OSD, and we asked for 2.5 billion. We were allocated 1 billion. The HIV and AIDS grant, we asked for 1 billion. We were allocated 0.3 billion. In other words, 300 billion. For child mortality, this is the vaccine that we referred to earlier, we asked for 350 million rand, and we were finally given 50 billion rand. The conditional grant to roll over, this is what I've been referring to earlier on, amounted to 376 million. Now, if we look at what's happening in the provinces at this point in time, in terms of the finances, in terms of the honourable members, we see the slide which indicates the situation as regards health spending at the end of July in 2008. Now, maybe on the left-hand side, we've got the provinces, then we've got the main budget, which adds up to 69 billion. Then we have the projected outcome. And this is a very important column. This is the outcome as envisaged and forecast by the accounting offices of the various health departments. And that amounts to 74.9 billion. Now, the actual, as at the end of July, is over there, which is about 33.5 billion. Then it gives us the actual as a percentage of the main budget. Now, at this point in time, the 31st of July, provinces should have spent about 33.3%. Now, the yellows indicate those provinces that are overspending, and the green indicates a province which is underspending. That is the city they went to Cape at this point in time. The under-over column here is the difference between the main budget and the projected outcome. Honourable members will then take note that the projected overrun at that point in time, at the 31st of July, was 5.5 billion. There's a small under expenditure projected by Northwest, but the total figure is 5.5 billion. Just a few other comments about this. This is the audited outcome as at the 31st of July. This is the year-on-year growth. Honourable members will see that there's a 27% growth year-on-year from last year's audited figures to this year. Can we move on? OPEC is one back. The largest overrun comes from Gauteng and KwaZulu, and those are also the provinces with the largest budget. So there seems to be a correlation between size of budget and size of overrun. Can we move on? We then look at the personnel expenditure as in isolation. This now gives us the same picture as we had earlier on. Same, the budget, 38 billion. The outcome, 42 billion. The overrun, 4.5 billion. So that indicates to us that out of the total of 5.5 billion, the HR overrun is going to be about 4.5 billion. Again, the total growth in year-on-year growth is 34%, which is quite phenomenal. Can we move on? If we talk about, just look at the HR situation, the total overrun is 5.5. The improved conditions of services, we calculated in the health sector, could be approximately 1.2 billion. This is the increase due to the fact that the final increase that staff was given after the strike was more than what we budgeted for. The
Then there's a further adjustment of in terms of the goods and services, which we estimated to be about 1 billion. So we estimated in the Department of Health that we could get approximately 3 billion from the fiscal from in this exercise. We just also indicated that we requested 2.8 and the budget that we were given was 1.5. Can we move on? Now the adjustment budget that we received in this particular column and slide, we've got the provinces on the left hand side, we've got the approved budget, which members will recall adds up to 69 billion, and then Treasury gave us 1 billion rand for the OSD. That is split at this point in time by way of the equitable share formula. Then we've got the ITS, and our estimate was a bit higher. Treasury gave us 845 million. And that's again split by the equitable share formula. Then we have the goods and services top up, which amounted to 473. Treasury also gave us 300 million more for HIV and AIDS, the HIV and AIDS conditional grant. This is to satisfy the additional demand that we are experiencing in the uptake of HIV and AIDS preventative drugs, or it's not really preventative drugs, but less the ARV in this particular instance. Now, the allocation here is as indicated to me, which came from what was approved by the MINCOM VAT at this point in time. Then there's 50 million for the child mortality, which is really the vaccine amount, and that's again split here in by way of what we thought in the department could be the best. The conditional grant, and this is very specific, as indicated in the rollover project, province by province, item by item. This tells us that in total the health sector received 3 billion rand. Now, if we move on, that tells us that the amount of money that we're receiving is 1.845 million for HR and goods and services is 881. That tells us it's 2.7. Now, if honorable members will remember, we said that there's going to be an overrun in the provinces of 5.5 billion. If we deduct this additional amount given to us, we end up at a likely overrun of 2.8 billion. Now, that sounds like a very big number, but let's just try and put this a little bit in perspective. The total health budget was 69 billion, and we have received 3 billion additional to that. That makes it 72 billion. And the overrun of approximately 2.8, 2.5 thereabouts gives us then an overrun in the vicinity of 3%. It's not to be condoned, but it must also be seen in context. Now let's talk about the unfunded budget bit. At the time when the wage negotiations took place in the bargaining council, it was agreed that the nurses will be first in the queue, because at that point in time it was thought that the need was the most acute in that particular area. The allocation was made, and I would say at this point in time there's been a rather heavy overrun on that, and we have teams of auditors going into the provinces to verify exactly what has happened. Where OSD was applied wrongly, where it was applied in a friendly way, or whatever the case may be. We will know the results from the audit in the first two provinces by the end of this week. The percentage growth, but what is more from more of a difficulty and an unfunded
problem to us is the fact that at that negotiations at the bargaining council, promised doctors, dentists, EMS workers, pharmacists, and others were promised that they will be in the queue for their OSD this year in which we are now. We received no money for that particular function or that requirement. The next one is the ARVs. Members will remember that we received 300 million. It's a good start, but the uptake is demand driven at this point in time. And the demand is just higher than what the funding it provides for. And this year we may still get by, but the growth in the forward year is too low. The growth in the uptake of the ARV sits in the vicinity of 30% plus. So the allocation needs to keep track with that particular figure more or less. Unless the demand will in the future drop off, but there doesn't seem to be any sign of that at this point in time. The allocation to hospital revitalization grant is not enough, and it is far short from what we requested. And we will have to think of new and innovative interventions to expedite this. The chair said earlier when we were here and education was in the hot seat, we should be innovative around this. But and there are ways in which we can leverage some money to take this program forward. Then there's the item that's been mentioned for quite a few times during this discussion by Dr. And this is the health information system, the e-health system. We received no funding for this particular item. And bearing in mind that and I'm sure the members of the audit, the committee will recall this, the Auditor General is now tightening up on the process of auditing and non-financial information. And this is our Achilles heel in health at this point in time. The lack of information to prove exactly what is happening in our health system. And we really need some funding for this. Now, challenges, and these are mostly systemic challenges. When we looked at the slide, which was the one which had a number 7, and maybe Shulani, if you can just move to that one. I indicated to the honorable members that the allocation for the OSD in this particular case is based on the equitable share formula. Maybe a more equitable way of distributing the money could be to do it by way of the number of nurses who qualify for the OSD per province. The second one is ICS, and I think that can be done by way of the equitable share formula and also the good service. HIV and AIDS, I do believe we need to reward provinces where the need is biggest and the work is being done which creates the demand. So therefore, we need to be very careful in the allocation of that. The child, that's one point, and maybe just to finish that point, I must say the Treasury are amenable to move to formulas other than the equitable share formula. And that, in the past, they were fairly rigid about that, but we seem to have some movement on that. The other problem that we have, honorable members and chairpersons, is the amount of money. If we look at the 50 million for the child, the vaccine to the child mortality, in terms of a, excuse me, in terms of the allocation for the province, it's relatively small enough. Even with, okay, it's four million, which is not all that much money. And that tends to disappear in the sand. Dr. Jürgen Pelle talked about the question of the allocation for TV last year. Some of that, just again, is at provincial level, it disappears into the sand. It doesn't end up in the provincial budget as requested. And that is, to us, in the health sector, quite a problem. We didn't go into the other slide. I talked about the bid processes where provincial treasury allocations doesn't talk to what we want. We also talked about the equitable share formula that doesn't always address the need. And then there's a continuous challenge to retain the services for health professionals in our service. Honourable Chair, I think that's where my colleagues take over from me again.
Yeah, I think in terms of conclusion, while we've seen in some areas, as the CFO has mentioned, some increases in the budget, which we very think, there are still significant budget pressures in some areas. And I think we've highlighted that fairly clearly, and we will stop our presentation there.
Well, thank you very much. I hope that I did the presentation. Now we're over to Kodik. Well, before we come to that, I don't know if Nathan Feller would like to make some input at this stage.
We're off to prepare a presentation, but we'll be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thanks, Chair, and thanks to the department for the presentation. Just one thing I've noticed, that they seem to have spent a lot of time talking about the current budget. Maybe I've missed it, but they haven't really been talking about the allocation over the MTEs. Now, the department has raised, even in the initial stages of their presentation, a number of challenges, areas where there are serious constraints, etc. Perhaps could the department maybe just give us an indication. These challenges that raised, and these things that they were speaking about early on in their presentation, how does the allocations over the MTEF period impact on these challenges? How will the allocations of the MTEF resolve some of the shortcomings they're talking about? I think that's really what we're wanting to hear about. That would be my first question, Chair. But I want to just talk a couple of points I want to raise. Last week we had the Human Science Research Council appear before the Joint Budget Committee, and they raised a number of matters, and some of which have been addressed already, such as issues of capacity in terms of human resources, etc. And so I'd like to then ask you to just tell us how do we intend to address some of these problems? Because we were given some rather alarming things, information. For instance, issues of stock management of medicines. We were told that in many instances there's no stock management whatsoever. So now this is what we were told. So I don't know whether it's right or wrong. That's what I would hope you'd help us on this. But we were told that often these things are just dumped in the passage. They get stolen. They get removed. So that nobody knows where these things are, what impact it's making. And I imagine it in some cases relates to shortages of medicines, etc. As I spoke, the issue of capacity, serious shortfalls in terms of capacity.
capacity of qualified personnel in positions. The other major thing, and that's what I'd like you to address as well, is the quality of service that they raised with us. It's just the level of service and the response of people who use the health system just indicating they're not satisfied with the type of service they get. How is the budget over the MTF going to address that? I just want to raise a particular example with you. It's a complaint that one gets when I visit clinics and other health facilities, is that people will often sit in a queue all day, either waiting to see a doctor, a nurse, or whatever, or waiting to get medicine. And come close of business, the doors just get closed, and they get told, come back tomorrow. Now, I want to raise a scenario, because you know, if you go to a bank, and you're in the queue at a bank, when the bank closes, they don't kick you out. They help everybody who's in the bank, who's in the queue. Even if it means the staff has to work longer hours, because the bank knows they've got to service their clients. Now, I'm wondering why, in the health sector, this doesn't apply. Surely the health sector is providing service. I think it also relates to the training of healthcare workers. So that's just really the issue I wanted to raise. Thanks, Chief.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I've got about a few questions. I'm going to stick to one. And that refers to priority four, item 12 on that priority four, which relates to the improvement of service delivery in the primary health sector. And, Chair, the primary health sector was transferred from local authorities to provinces last year. And one of the things which was done by the local authorities was the question of mobile clinics, which was also raised by Dr. Pillay. Now, these mobile clinics did a wonderful job because they actually went to the poorest of the poor, where the people couldn't get into town, it was difficult for them to get there, but they could do their family planning at the mobile clinic. Now those mobile clinics are no longer being used for that purpose. They're being used for transporting staff. So these people are not getting the service of a mobile clinic in the areas where they reside, and it's just been stopped. They don't, and I don't know what's going to happen to family planning and all the other problems related to it. I don't know whether it's related to all the provinces, but certainly in the Western Cape that is the case. And I wonder if we have any comment from Dr. Pillay as well.
Anything
else?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, in the presentation, I must appreciate the on key text is an understanding of clinical and of hospitals in my area. There are shortages of the generators are not working, where the facilities, beds, blankets, and so forth are short. In terms of the beds, machinery and X-ray machine, the time level is hard, or it is short, it is not very helpful. It's part of the key. And how are you addressing this, given this to understand? Because I would have expected you to ask for more money in this day. And then on the occupation specific dispensation, is this accommodated in this budget, in the 3-year budget, or because we're talking mainly about this year's budget. Have you included that in the 3-year budget, and if so, how much have you provided for? Do you think that you have provided for enough in terms of And then lastly, on the health information management. I mean, given the problems that we are having in hospitals, including the ones that have been mentioned by Honorable Shema, this begins with having information. If we do not have information, how else do we respond to the problems that are there in the hospital in a systematic manner, and then how do we then prioritize? Because if there is a deficiency in the line of information, then there is a big problem. And I don't think we have shortages of skills in all areas, including areas of organizing information. Because information can be divided into information which requires a computer, but also information, because there are files in hospitals, there are numbers of people. Why not? You can say no. There were so many people that were serviced by this staff, by Jenny. We need so many doctors and so many nurses for so many patients today. So that information does not reach the doctors. But it seems that there is a problem in it there. I'm not talking about, yeah, there is other information when you project it to the future. But also, given our experience, we are projecting to the future using the past few years. If you get what I mean, Dr. And then the issue of these increases that are there, which are about three times the CPI rate of inflation. What is the problem? What causes our inflation to be much more than the national inflation? Thank you.
Saying to us, you know, this is what
we need to do in the next 5 years if you prioritize health. We all agree on that based on, you know, the practical review of our challenges.
Make sure all the information systems we have over the years and in future although independent from department to department, they must interact or they must be able to be compatible to each other in the next 10, 20 years. We don't want to have problems integrating different data. And also in connection with the actual implementation, is it going to be only for public sector, or are you going to include the private sector hospitals, particularly the individual practices, and also with reference to the rural areas, those clinics or smaller scale medical centers in the rural areas, how are they going to participate in terms of at what stage are you going to bring them on, given that there would be infrastructure challenges and also communication challenges, given that there's electronic, assuming some sort of communication via wireless link or existing cables must happen. And if you look at a lot of rural areas, they're not going to have this facility. They don't even have 3G, never mind wireless link. So I think this is more or less how this project is going to roll out in our next 3 years, and how this is going to impact our budget for the next 3 years.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair. Mine perhaps just clarification. We know that additional funds would make a difference, but you yourself made a reference to the lack of being able to get a national data system up running successfully. Yes, that's South Africa. We do have a lot of sound information coming out of them about deaths and this sort of thing. Example, the last 9 years, the mortality rate doubled, people under the age of 30 and so on. We know from the death certificates just how many infants have died, how many babies. We have that information on the death certificates, which is highly national. Now, the problem is the death rate keeps on rising. Yes, money is important. What would be useful to know, we spoke about quality of this kind of thing, is cleanliness in the hospital itself. It doesn't take a lot of money. Really does not. You know, we ran the DRT a couple of years back, where there's just no drugs. You need any medicine, you have to purchase it yourself. But the mortality rate is so much lower, in the hospital, you can eat off the floor. I mean, there's got to be something that can be done without just increasing the financial resource dramatically in the hospital area. Basic things, the washing of hands and so on. And what measures are being taken to do away with the recycling of things like catheters and endotracheal tubing and that kind of thing. Managing the waste outside. How's waste going to be managed? Waste food, waste injections, that kind of thing, needles, that kind of thing. So I'm asking, what efficiency measures have actually been implemented in the light of